Today's program has been brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
Broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
That song will get you going every morning. What's up? This is The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. Today we're going to be talking about time. T-I-M-E, as in the tick of a clock. Nice, Joe. Way to start off soft. But it came in. It built. We are going to be talking about time, and we're going to have Damien Sansonetti, the executive chef of Bar Balloud. We're going to talk all time, 40 minutes on time and the restaurant, because he was just telling me at the bar that all of restaurant world is defined by time. But first, I want to present this heritageradionetwork.org. We're a 501c3, the members-only party. It's September 9th. That's September 9 from 5 to 8 p.m. at Roberta's Restaurant, 261 Moore Street, where we broadcast from into repurposed shipping containers. This will be the food. Roberta's will do food. Gramercy Tavern will do food. Back 40 West. Del Posto is going to come. Brooks Headley is going to do a bunch of cool desserts and cookies. Momo Sushi Shack. Inside Park, Matt Weingarten, Brooklyn's own Parish Hall, which they also own Egg, Saxelby Cheesemongers and Heritage Meat Shop are going to be doing an Essex Street Market table with cheese and charcuterie and bread from the Essex Street Market. Seat a Table is giving the fish to Parish Hall. And we're going to have cocktails by Dave Arnold, which will include El Bujo Mezcal, Galliano L'Autentico, Absolute Vodka, Plymouth Gin, and Perrier Jouet. Beer by GreatBrewers.com, including Greenpoint Harbor Brewing, and wine from our sponsor for today's show, Cane Vineyard and Winery. So visit the homepage or go to heritageradionetwork.eventbrite, B-R-I-T-E. com. And tickets are $150. VIP tickets, where you get private tours of all the local businesses, including the sushi place and a new chocolatier that's opening up on Siegel Street. You know, those cost $250. So buy your tickets today. It is a tax deductible ticket. So now we get back. By the way, I want to say we're engineered and produced by Joe Galarraga. Joe, are you there?
Hey, how's it going, Patrick?
Hey, Joe. How's that? Any new music updates that you want to plug?
No, not really. You know, it's well, now, right now at the radio station, we're trying to collect a catalog of local musicians that want to have their music played on the Heritage Radio Network. So if you're listening and you're in a band or you make music or anything like that, you know, we take all these breaks and we have all these post-produced pieces by Jack, so send us your music and we can, you know, use it in the shows.
I was worried about your work ethic, and now you confirmed it. We always take breaks. So today we are talking about timing. So timing. Is there a sound effect for timing? New sound effect. Ooh. Old school. So we have Damien Sansonetti, an old friend of mine, the executive chef of Bar Balloud. Welcome, Damien.
Thank you.
Thanks for getting up so early on a Sunday. What time did you work till last night, talking about time?
About 12 o'clock.
12 o'clock. And you live where? In Manhattan? In
beautiful, lovely Queens.
Oh, in Queens. Wow. So you took the stepchild of the subway system, the G train over here?
Yes, the G train.
Oh, my God. Talk about timing. That's probably bad timing. So we're talking about all the tick-tock of the restaurant world. So let's start off with the most basic of timing, which would probably most interest our listeners, the timing of a dinner. And we should just describe Bar Balloud is one of Danielle Balloud's restaurants. It's right in front of Lincoln Center. It opened...
We opened in actually... Our first night of service was New Year's Eve of 2007. Quite a night to open up for first service.
Oh, man. Everyone's so drunk. And then, wow, that's interesting timing.
Yes.
And now you've been there for years. How many seats are there?
We have about 110 seats in the main dining room. And during the beautiful months of the spring and summer and early fall, we had about 70 or so more seats to our lovely terrace on Broadway.
So about 200 seats
Close to it, season. Yeah.
And then you have basically 200 seats, and you have the added challenge of the pre-theater, because, I mean, obviously, yes, everyone going to Lincoln Center or any of the Broadway shows, they've got to be in and out. But then you have regular people come and expect everything from long, drawn-out meals to quick business meals. So very interesting person to talk about timing with as it relates to the restaurant industry. So let's start us off, Damien. Tell us about timing of a dinner from when that person first goes up to your hostess desk and gives their name for the reservation.
Right. Well, I mean, timing starts out right when they're greeted by the host and the maitre d' and sat down at their table. And, you know, we go through what we call the steps of service. And there's a certain amount of time that we try and adhere to with greeting them, presenting them the menus, approaching for a drink order, getting them the bread and also the canapes, which we do at Barbaluda, or gougères that everybody absolutely loves. And that's another whole timing in its own, to have warm, fresh gougères come out for the guests.
Are those made in advance, or are those...
They're made... You have to make them a little in advance, but then they're baked off in a rotation. So we bake them off in small batches. So literally about... There's almost always a tray of gougères baking in the oven because they take about 30 minutes to bake. So you want to make sure that you have enough, but you don't want them to sit too long either. So you have them kind of almost baked off in about a 15-minute batch interval. Mm-hmm. So we have them going all the time for the guests, because when they get a nice, beautiful, nice, warm, puffy gougère, I mean, just to start your evening off with, it's a good, you know, thing that's going to come later. And you go through the steps of it, and you don't want to have too much time in between. But there are people that will want to take a little more time, but that's after that. But when you come up to just, as soon as that ticket gets rung in to the
kitchen. What? So the person sits, how long before a waiter comes, and how long before they give their order?
They should have about a good 2 minutes or so until, I would say no more than 2 minutes until the waiter touches the table and greets them with the menus and lets them ponder over the menu. And then after about a few more minutes after that, to get the drink order, or if they're ready to order, they can place their order then after that. Once that order is taken, then, you know, bread hits the table, gougères hit the table.
So once the order's in.
Once the order's in. And that way, you're in the restaurant for less than 10 minutes now. And you have, you know, your gougères with you coming up. And you have, you know, your order placed in the kitchen. Your drink order, if you order cocktails, bartender's starting to make cocktails. If you ordered wine, the sommelier is retrieving the bottle from either our chilled wine storage or from the cellar downstairs for you.
Now, pre-theater, will you try to get the order right away?
Pre-theater, you try and work because you
versus
have...
Versus a drink?
Well, you always want to have somebody to have their beverage before the food comes. Because it's always nice to wet your palate, you know, and have that ready. And so you can also conversate with the sommelier, because we are a wine bar, and we do serve large format bottles every night for, we call it the panier du jour. And it's something special to offer beautiful wines at almost cost price. So if you want to, like, you know, talk with the sommelier a little bit, that's where it kind of gives us a little more time to make up certain things or certain mm-hmm. orders. So during pre-theater, you know, you usually can dine from start to finish in around an hour and a half.
Wow. So in and out in an hour and a half.
Right.
And that's an appetizer, main course, and a dessert.
That's a three-course meal, correct. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting. So that person you just said is there 10 minutes usually, and by that time the drink's about to come out, their bread and gougère is about to come out,
right?
And then that ticket, quote unquote, comes down via computer to your
exactly.
To you,
we get it.
Who's we? Like, who gets that?
Well, we get a micros machine, and the hotline and the garmage and the pastry station each have their own micros printers. So we'll get the ticket in. You know, most appetizers take around, let's say, maximum 10 minutes to make. So we're looking at the time frame of when something has to go upstairs and what needs to get done. And, you know, some things you have to jump on right away. Some things, you know, are a little bit slower. So there's some things like, you know, you make a soup and it goes pretty quickly. There's some stuff that you have to roast off, like our popular frisée salad with the lardons and the chicken livers. And we make the dressing a la minute. So, and if you don't know what a la minute means, it's like, you know, of the minute or of that time frame right there. So it's right there. And it may take a little longer than making a soup, but we time that out so everything can come up at the same time. So then again, time. Because you don't want to have something sitting. And even though right now we're serving chilled soup, you don't want your chilled soup to get warm waiting mm-hmm. for a salad. It would take long.
So tell us the spectrum of appetizers. You say 10 minutes at the most, and then what's the least? And like you won't start everything at the same time for the very reason you just mentioned.
Right. Cooks will talk to each other and communicate through the stations and talk to say, okay, how long do you need on so-and-so? Because my saucier will pick up the morteau, which is a smoked braised sausage with lentil stew. And that will take more time than making a chilled soup, because a chilled soup goes in the bowl, you have your garnish, you know, and you know, garnished up the oils or a fried basil, say for example for our gazpacho right now, and that will literally take a minute and a half to prep up and put in the bowl for you.
So he's going to start that right when the other guy's finishing the 10 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. So that everything comes up, and that's less of a challenge time wise than say whenever you have to deal with your entrees. So that's upstairs. And then, you know, we'll wait and we'll look at the ticket times because we are very focused on the time. Because, you know, people want to dine in a certain frame. And there are will be guests that will talk and be like, okay, I want to, you know, just relax. And, you know, there's a guest, a couple last night, and they just, you know, they were going to let the waiter know that, you know, they ordered a bottle of wine for each course and they wanted to relax.
Well, I would say a bottle of wine for each course. They were probably fast asleep at their seats.
They had the time of their life. And we also had a couple last night that got engaged at the restaurant because it was their first time. They had their first date at Barbaloo 2 years ago, and then they got engaged last night.
That sounds awesome. Now, of course, those are the extreme peoples. Is there another communication that goes on between the wait staff and the kitchen if the person is just eating unusually slow? Or is that just you to kind of gauge a middle ground?
Well, the wait staff will call downstairs on the phone because we are a two-level restaurant where the kitchen's downstairs. And they'll say, okay, you know, table 46 is having their charcuterie slow. And usually you can kind of almost gauge after being there for almost 5 years. You gauge how quick people will eat things. Like a soup and a salad, people tend to eat quickly. But there are exceptions where people will just get into conversations and just kind of, you know. But then that's where we also have with the steps of service where we engage our guests and ask them, oh, are you going to the theater tonight? Mm-hmm. Because during that 5 o'clock to 7 o'clock frame, you want to make sure that if they have theater tickets, you want to have them eating properly and out at a certain time. And there will be guests that come in a little late. Something happened when it rained outside. They got out of work late, but they still want to come and eat, and they want to eat good food. So we try our best to accommodate them and still get them to the theater in a good time frame. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why we're still successful when we've been there and we're so busy.
So timing-wise, the appetizer, so it could take from 2 minutes to 10 minutes, but essentially the second you get that order ticket, then you are basically making those long appetizers, the ones that take the most amount of time, or do you wait 5 minutes?
No, the appetizers will start making right away. Appetizers start going right away. The thing also, too, is that you start making certain ingredients for the entrees. Because, say, you order a medium steak. Well, a medium steak, cooking it from raw, will take you a little bit of time because you want to cook it and you need that time to rest it.
How long?
You would season it, put it in the pan, and usually by the time that you're ready to fire the ticket, we usually wait about a good, you know, we look at the ticket times, and most people will eat during pre-theater a good 15, 20 minutes after the ticket's in the kitchen, it's ready to go. Mm-hmm. So then it takes us anywhere from another 10 to 15 minutes to prepare, complete, and cook everything else that needs to be made to go for the entree. So that way, you know, by around a half an hour to 40 minutes of the ticket being in the kitchen, you will be receiving your main course.
So then you will, the second the appetizers go up and you're like, okay, table 46 just got their four appetizers, you'll wait. Some ingredients will have started already, and correct, the majority of your main courses start after that, after those appetizers leave? Or it's,
well,
really
there's things that are like fish, that if you had a fish with skin on it, like a dorade, you would, that thing waits till the very last minute because you want to have that, needs the quick little amount of time because you want that skin to stay crispy. But if you have something that's a braise, and in the restaurant we glaze things, with their braising liquid, so that kind of reduces but seeps back into the meat, like our coq au vin, which we still sow so much coq au vin, even in the summertime. It baffles my mind, but it's a well-made and executed dish. So
it's a winter dish, really.
Yeah, but it's full of flavor and hearty, but when it's made right, I think in the summertime, people still just want to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But that will be kind of being made, you know, and you need to keep going with it and glazing it and making it hot and making it beautiful. And like we talked about the steak too, but then if you have another piece of fish that, say, we've done butter poached halibut before, it needs a little more time. So the cooks have to know how long something will take. And, you know, you do play kind of a little bit of a game sometimes when you're doing pre-theater, because there are times where, you know, we don't want the guests to wait and we don't want to make it too early. So it's always kind of like, that's when you're sweating your time, because you want to make it the best possible way and have it come up great. And, you know, there's always those terms of like people say, like sandbagging or doing that. And we don't want to do that. We want to try and have stuff that comes in. You want to cook it fresh. You want to make it right.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Now, I never understood why dessert doesn't get ordered. I mean, it just seems now that these pastry chefs are taken so seriously. And, you know, we have witnessed, I mean, we've had in studio the people that are responsible for, you know, literally the birth of pastry in America. I mean, it's not, doesn't go as far back as 100 years. I mean, this was, forget that woman. I think her name is something Fleming from Gramercy Tavern.
Yeah, Claudia.
I mean, Claudia Fleming. I mean, people really credit her with this whole new chapter. So it's very, very new. So I'm surprised, though, that even though it's new, it hasn't been the fact that you have to order your dessert with your regular meal, because don't they need time for their stuff?
Well, pastry is usually divided into two sections. And most people don't realize this, but it's kind of like when pastry cooks are working, they love, there's two things they like to do. There's pastry plating and there's pastry production. And pastry production, there's, and with the birth of almost newer cuisines now, you know, with what came out of Spain years ago and, you know, and other parts of Europe and what's been kind of brought here to America too, there's certain more things that are almost a la minute now, but those are finishing touches. So, you know, you're not going to bake a cake or a biscuit or a genoise or something like that a la minute, because you wouldn't be able to glaze it or put anything on it because it'd be too warm. But there are things that you will make or bake, like madeleines, you know, a la minute, because you want those perfect, just that little crust on it and just tender and soft in the middle. But then there's a lot of it has to do with, you know, you already have your tart shell and you already have things that you already have made, so you're going to execute those things as a pastry cook when you're plating things up and finish the plates. So there's a different kind of thing of doing a production versus doing a plating. And there's, but nowadays you try and mix up a lot of different things. So, you know, when you start mixing different things, like my wife's a pastry chef, and I mean, she's amazing, but, you know, she'll try and do as much as she can, you know, right out the way. But there's also things that she has to make ahead of time, because if she tried to bake all of her tarts literally like every 20 minutes in the service,
everyone would miss their theater.
Oh yeah. You wouldn't be able to serve anybody.
Yeah, for sure. Well, now we're going to do a sound effect of a clock, and then we're going to go to our next timing issue. Joe, are you still there?
I love the clock.
Is that just Joe making that sound with his mouth? So that's good. That's a good one. Not as good as the old grandfather clock earlier, but still pretty solid. Good job, Joe. So now talk about timing of an evening of service. So, for instance, let's look at yesterday, and you come in for dinner, you know, which starts where? What time?
Well, dinner service or even service period for me, I mean, yesterday I was up at 7.
7 a.m.?
7 a.m. I went into Manhattan and went to the Union Square Green Market. So kind of my service and my sous chef and one of my cooks came down with me. We start getting ingredients for the day's service.
That you know what you're looking for? You're kind of like, we're going to make a mixed salad with whatever is most interesting.
Well, some stuff we know we're going to get for our menu that we count on. And there's also ingredients that are super micro-seasonal or that somebody does really cool or really nice, and we're going to get that. And if they have it, we'll use it for the special for the night.
Okay.
But we, you know, my service starts then when I get there at 9 o'clock and get my coffee. And then we walk around, we pick up our heirloom tomatoes, our haricot jaune, our tri-star strawberries, our cucumbers. I mean, all the stuff that we use on the, in the restaurant. And we go there, you know, about three times a week. And then we'll go back there. Brunch starts at 11. So we get back at the restaurant around 10:30 or so. Brunch starts at 11 o'clock. And, you know, we have a busy brunch service.
Now, that's your perspective. Now, people have been there much earlier already. Certain guys are cutting carrots. And every time I would make a delivery to Bar Balloon, I mean, there was always already a team of people there.
My saucier gets there. He's the first person at night, or in the morning. My saucier gets there at 5 o'clock in the morning.
Why so early?
You need him to get there because whenever he's in charge of stock, sauces, braises, confits, things that take time. These are those kind of classic French things that, you know, some of us have kind of gotten away from, but they're a good building block for and the basis for a lot of things. But, you know, when you want to make a duck confit, I mean, you're invested in time for about a good 5 hours.
Doing what? I mean, take us through some of the steps. I mean, is he boiling things? And
he rolls in at 5, turns on all the ovens, opens up all the walk-ins. And starts pulling things out. Like, say he needs to make veal stock. Take out the veal bones, put them on trays, make sure the oven's up to temperature, and pop them in the oven to start roasting them. And then from there, he'll deglaze his pans, roast his veg, get all of his aromatics in, and then pop everything in the stock pots. And then that veal stock will go for about 24 hours overnight, and he'll take it off the next morning when he comes in. Or he'll do, like, the duck confit, rinse off all the spices and the herbs and everything. Pat them a little dry so you don't have too much more excess moisture going into it. Melt the duck fat, put it in, bring up the temperature, and then cook it, you know, until the duck legs are just tender enough. Take them out, let them rest, and then remove them when they've rested for about an hour or so in their own fat, so they're not too hot and they're not cold yet either, and then portion them and repackage them in their own duck fat and store them.
That's an interesting thing you brought up a couple times, resting. You can't serve a steak right after it comes out. You can't. This duck confit needs to be rested. There's a lot of just it kind of cooling down and getting down to room temperature, right? So then continue then with your day. That's interesting. 5 o'clock, that guy gets there. And then, so you're meanwhile at the farmer's market, and then you'll come back to the restaurant, and what will you do?
Yeah, so when I get back to the restaurant, we'll get into brunch service, and myself and the sous chefs will kind of assess, okay, say, you know, so-and-so company didn't deliver us the romaine lettuce that we need for the beef tartare for nighttime, so we have to call in a second run. So that way, that time kind of delays the garmage cooks to not have what they need to be prepped out. But then they focus their efforts on something else, and you just pray that they get here on time. Wow. Otherwise, you're running to Food Import to pick up romaine.
Spending a lot of money. Now, so you can get same-day delivery from a lot of vegetable guys.
If you call it early and enough, yeah. Mm-hmm. But Saturdays are always that hairy thing because you never know what's going to happen.
What the weekend will bring.
Right.
So brunch, are you recycling things that you didn't sell throughout the week, or are you doing original work for brunch too? I mean, there's not really a French culture of brunch, is there?
There's not really that I'm really aware of, but kind of we've made French-style brunch items. Like, I love this dish that we came up with when we first opened up, and it was, you know, I love corned beef hash. And that's one of my favorite things to eat when I have brunch with, you know, poached eggs. And I go to a diner and I always order, you know, corned beef hash and poached eggs, and I love it. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, okay, let's do something different. So we are a French restaurant. What do you usually go in a French restaurant? Duck confit. So you make a duck confit hash with a slow poached, like, 63-degree egg on top of it. And watercress. And I mean, it's one of our biggest sellers.
Mm-hmm.
And even our croque monsieur and croque madame, which, I mean, it's just so decadent yet elegant. It's, you just want to have one when you go in.
Yeah. All right. So we're talking timing. So you will go, but are you in charge of brunch? I mean, you're the executive chef. I mean, are you there making omelets and stuff, or are you just preparing for dinner?
I'm there. I'm helping. We expedite throughout the line. I'll be behind the line with my sous chef who's running the back line of the kitchen on the hotline with the cooks. And, you know, because you want to make sure that everything goes as effectively as it does. I mean, everybody thinks sometimes executive chefs or chef de cuisines don't cook, but I think now in our business, I think a lot more of us do cook than they did before in the past. And part of it's because we got in this business because we love it and we love to cook food. And it's those days when you're doing those non-chefy or those non-cooking things, and you're like, you know, doing bills or schedules and paperwork that you're like, I just want to be in the kitchen. So, you know, we do get behind the line. We are cooking. And yeah, I've had to show my cooks, you know, when they've come in, because you believe how many cooks don't know how to make an actual omelet. But you have to show them how to do it. And, you know, you have to be behind the line with them and give them the support they need and to help them up and everything too. So we all work together as a team. And, you know, like the other day we were behind and, you know, the line, and I had to shift everybody around. So everybody kind of shifted a little bit of a station to help out one station that was really getting in the weeds. So that way that time for those dishes was shortened instead of being, because sometimes that will happen. You'll get all the dishes ordered off of one station, and every cook has had that happen to them. They've had that night, and they're like,
they're just falling behind.
Yeah, and you have to get there with them so they make sure that the time that would make longer for them to produce more is shortened.
Well, you have rovers, right? And there are critical times that can go. I mean, you have an extra guy on hand.
Yeah, you have tournants, you have sous chefs that can move, and we move around and we go to where we need to give support. And you always want to give support in the kitchen wherever you can. And that even goes as to, you know, I've run food to tables before because our restaurant's so big, and some of them guests, like, they look like, what's, like, how are you today, Madame Monsieur? You know, we have your steak frites here and your roasted chicken.
You're like, this is a crock, madame, but here, I'm the freaking chef bringing you the... Well, back onto the time issue. Joe, feel free to, you know, keep us on the time track with the sound effect whenever you want. But so then brunch, when does brunch end?
Brunch ends around 3:30, 4 o'clock.
3:30, 4 o'clock. And then after your... overcoming the trials and tribulations of brunch, when does actually official, I mean, not the stuff that you've been prepping for days and hours and all that, but when does dinner service, like, when does that staff come? When is that team meeting?
Dinner staff starts to show up in the restaurant around between 1 and 2 o'clock, depending upon their shift.
Wow.
And they, once they get there and they check their mise en place, they start figuring out what they have to start doing first, because as a cook, you have a time frame yourself of what I need to do first so I can get that going. It's going to take me the longest, and what I can do the last thing before those doors open for 5 o'clock dinner service.
And that's up to them. I mean, you start probably shadowing them a lot at the beginning, but eventually they're making those decisions.
Yeah, every cook's going to react a little differently, and each one has a set of strengths that they can play off on each of their stations, and they figure out how to work their stations, you know, and how to get everything going for that. And most of them, once they get the hang of it, there's always a nice little kind of curve of figuring out. Some cooks pick it up a little quicker than others, and you're always there too, as you know, all of my sous chefs and myself will be able to work the stations with the cooks. So we can show them how to do the dishes or how to work it or make sure that they're not understanding something, you know.
Now, so then what happens? Take us through the general timeline of a dinner. So people show up at 2-3 o'clock, start to do certain work, and then take us through, you know, closing, basically.
And then, well, we have, you know, pre-theater from between 5 and 7 o'clock with our pre-theater menu and the prefix menu. And then once after 7 o'clock, we have the full a la carte menu.
So that's how you assure people can get out by the theater. You limit what they can order.
It's a little bit slimmed down, and sometimes just because maybe the dish might take a little bit longer, or because you don't want them to... I mean, we have regulars, or we have people that will see a menu online like, oh, well, we don't have that in the menu right now. You know, could we have the Boudin Noir? And I'm like, yeah, of course, no problem. If a customer asks for something and requests something that we might not have in the menu at that time, as long as I have the ingredients and have the mise en place for it, I'm more than happy to serve it to them.
You're like, did they say Boudin Tartare or Boudin Noir? Because you have no time to cook it. Well, very interesting. And then you'll do a post-theater too, where you're also kind of same as the theater menu. You're trying to get people out so that they're not there till 2 in the morning.
Right. Well, I mean, we do. I mean, post-theater for us, it varies. Like yesterday, the theater starts getting out at around 10 o'clock, but we're still open for regular service until 12. So we see three different seatings. And you have people that are still coming out for regular dining, or you have people that couldn't make it for pre-theater dining or just didn't want to dine before the theater and came out afterwards. And then they want to have a meal, they want to have wine. But then we also offer a menu after hours, kind of, for about an hour or so of a smaller menu, because most people don't want to eat a lot at those times, like from 12 to 1 or so.
Yeah.
But it's also a little smaller because it's like cheese, dessert, charcuterie. And it's things that they can kind of come nosh on a little bit it's usually a little lighter, some salads and soups too, because 10 people tend not to want to eat as much that late.
Right. Well, now we're going to transition. Still talking about time. Joe, do you have a transitional time? All very relaxed. Your clocks are all very relaxed. There's no like 60 minutes like tick, 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 tick.
The aggressive clock.
The aggressive clock.
That's copyrighted.
Oh, I know. That's absurd that they can copyright that. So let's talk about careers and timing.
Right.
So take us through the various positions. You know, how long do people stay at as a grand manger or as a pastry cook or as the executive chef or as a sous chef? I mean, I know obviously there's no black and white with this, but I mean, is there general industry practice or traditions for how long each of those positions stays? And maybe take us through some of those positions in relation to career times.
I mean, everybody in the restaurant, usually when I hire them in, starts out in the garmanger slash charcuterie area of the kitchen. And you know, they tend to spend anywhere, I would say the average time on there would be around 4 to 5 months. And they, yeah, there are exceptions to the rule. Sometimes there's cooks that are just, their natural skills are exemplary and they learn very quickly, and they kind of, you can tell some people are leaders, and they excel very well. But we use that to our advantage to show and teach and train other cooks around them so they can make the rest of the team stronger.
So grand manger, they are making salads and putting vinaigrettes on salads and cutting up vegetables for other stations, right?
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Some of it's basic stuff.
It's basics, but it's building blocks.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at it kind of in that way, it's a foundation, because there's things that they'll make there that later on it may be different ingredients or something of a different kind of technique, but they've learned a base thing that will bring them forward more, like, you know, making an emulsified vinaigrette versus, you know, maybe trying to make a sauce. And I teach them later, earlier, I'm like, remember when you made something like this back on Grand Marché? Like, oh, yeah. And yeah. I'm like, bing, it's like the light bulb goes off on their head.
How long is too long at the Grand Marché position? I mean, at what point are you looking at the person being like, yo, dude, you've been here way too long? Or, you know, it's starting to get to where you're not going to move on? Or, you know, what is that kind of lifespan of a Grand Marché?
No, I mean, I think it'll vary, because, I mean, it's kind of a double-edged sword in a way, too, because there are times when you have a kitchen and you just have some amazing cooks. And you have cooks that are doing really well on all the stations, and they're happy and they're executing things the right way, and there's no room for movement for them. And
so then when should they leave? After 3 years or after 6 months?
No, I mean, I would say, you know, most cooks should put in about a good year or so in restaurants, and because you never know what's going to happen to things, and sometimes you get moved a little too quick. Because I know when I was younger in my career, there were certain stations that I worked in restaurants, and I thought, oh man, I wish I could have maybe kind of hung out there maybe about 2 months more, just so I could see everything or get to cook with everything that I know that we would kind of go through, or like in the seasons. Because if you try and work, like we talk about a season, so if you kind of go about a season on a station, you're pretty good. So if you go about 4 months or so, 5 months on a station, you're pretty good, because you get to see the stuff that's in the season there for it. But then there's other times where, you know, it's a little too long. Like I've had cooks that, unfortunately, at certain period of time, it doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, they would be stuck somewhere in a good way, because it's a great kitchen. But, you know, if they would be able to go to another restaurant of ours or to a friend's restaurant of mine that I'd recommend them to. But the span of a cook, like I've had cooks that have stayed with me for almost 3 years.
So you're talking not Grand Mangers, you're talking about sous chefs.
I'm talking
point.
About the whole, well,
tell us brief positions. Grand Manger, one.
So you got Grand Manger, and sometimes people divide up in like one, two, or three, depending upon where it's at. Then for us, like for example, at Barbaloo, we go then, after that, you get kind of like, I call it the gateway station. It's the hot apps, because you do some cold preparations and you do some hot preparations, but you also work with Grand Manger. And it's the first time you kind of almost work by yourself. You don't have a team of people behind you. Then you do the entremetier, which is an AM and PM station, and that's like a vegetable station. You deal with all of the vegetables, prepping, mise en place, cooking of the restaurant for lunch and dinner. Then after that is the saucier, AM and PM. But saucier AM is more of almost kind of like a junior sous chef, or getting to be a tournant position.
Because he's in charge.
You're in charge in the morning before the sous chef gets there, you know, around 7 o'clock or so. And then you also learn to cook with a lot of love and things that people don't do, like we mentioned before, like the confits and the braises and the long stocks and stuff. Yeah. And then you have the cuisson, which cuisson during the dinner time is the heart of the line. You, when you're cooking a steak, and this is the timing thing, this guy has the power in his hands of, in a way, of, okay, I can go on table 136 and 46, but I still need two more minutes on 35. Okay, cool. So we're going to do plate these two tables up first.
Le cuisson est puissant. The cuisson is powerful in French. Very interesting. And then?
And then after that, you have the tournant. And usually the tournant is the guy that
Rover, the linebacker.
He's the guy that worked all the stations or can work all the stations.
That'd be my favorite. I would be going around all the time.
My tournant now loves the top. He loves it because he's like, he's so excited about it. And he,
it's great if you're ADD.
Good guy.
And then?
And then after that, you have sous chefs.
And that is basically, if you're not there, they are in charge. And they have to figure it out and make it happen.
Right.
They become you. They become Danielle. I mean, you're Danielle when Danielle's not there. When you're not there, the sous becomes you and all that. Right?
Exactly.
That's big. And how many sous at a place with 200 seats?
I have three sous chefs.
Okay.
And one executive sous chef. But one of the sous chefs is a banquet chef as well, because we also have three rooms that we do for private dining.
Huh.
So like right now in the summertime, we have a smaller amount. We have about three or four private events a week. But in the wintertime or in the season, I mean, we have sometimes all three rooms are booked every single night.
Wow. Well, now a quick transition. Joe, another sound effect, please. This has been very interesting about time. Time. What is this? Joe, is that...
It's a little bit more modern.
More modern clock? Okay. Okay, there we go.
It's on my alarm this morning. Time.
So, well, that's actually very good. It's an alarm because my next question was on spoilage and waste. So we're going to go fast now because I also want to talk about the restaurant and then talk about your future. But give us a quick thing on spoilage and waste at a restaurant. And then we're going to talk about aging and stuff like that. Like, how much stuff do you throw away?
Well, I mean, there's stuff that unfortunately sometimes will either get, you know, people make mistakes or... You know, they just don't last as long. And if you don't sell them, you can't use them. So you always are going to have some waste in every restaurant. Mm-hmm. But as a chef and as a manager, you try and manage that to the bare minimum. But there are things that, say, some people would waste. But as chefs, we get creative. So, you know, and this is where one of my big things is in that of trying to use up, like when we buy whole animals or do things like that and use off cuts of meat.
Well, what do you do with it?
Oh, I mean...
Make a meatloaf special for brunch or what?
Well, I had, you know, some pork liver and I had some pork blood that we didn't end up using for make the boudin blancs. And I made a pork liver dumpling, but I used the blood to help, you know, make it all come together. And I couldn't believe how much we sold of it. Because sometimes you don't know how things are going to sell to people. But it's using up all of those things, like pig ears off of a pig head. I mean... Mm-hmm. You know, there's so much stuff, and you see it more and more coming out now, because I think for us as chefs, it's fun for us now too, to kind of see what people will be willing to kind of eat of our creations that are a little off the wall at times, but they're also good.
Where do you and Danielle draw the line? I mean, you can't make something completely crazy either that's not in line with the overall menu.
No, I mean, you'll never see something like at Barbaloo that's, you
like
know,
a hamburger or something.
Well, you know, we've done kind of like a slider here or there type of thing. But no, if you want a burger, that's why you go to DB Bistro or you go to DBGB.
Right.
You know, or you won't see something that's blatantly very Asian inspired, you know, because we're a very French restaurant.
But you don't have as much playing room with fish, do you? I mean, when that goes, it goes, right? Or is there a last minute use of fish as well?
Well, there's not. I mean, fish does have a very small window, and you want to get it in as fresh as possible, and use it up as quick as possible. I mean, we have fish when we make, you know, kind of cured fish or a smoked fish in house. You know, we've done smoked bluefish for like a chowder earlier, or smoked trout. But I mean, even that, smoking and curing is a way back in the day to preserve things. But even like say a smoked salmon. I mean, it still has a time frame that you know that you don't want to use it.
Mm-hmm. And then, so basically you try, your first effort is always to try to use it first. Meats, I mean, they can go 40, 50, 60 days, right?
Meats, I mean, it's kind of funny when you talk about meats because you talk about dry aging. And anybody that's had a piece of dry aged meat, like a dry aged ribeye, I mean, the flavor of it, it's really rich. It's robust, I mean, but also a little delicate, and it's so tender. But I mean, in essence, it's a kind of spoiling piece of meat, but in the right temperature conditions and the right hands of somebody that can age it the properly way, I mean, it's like heaven.
Time and spoilage are a good thing in that. Right. Same with the cheeses and the charcuterie.
Right, and cheeses. Right? I mean, you have your cheeses. Some will age
and
for
wine.
Years, and they taste great. You wouldn't want them earlier.
Right.
And wine, there's like one of my more favorite wines is from the Jura, and they let their wine aerate on purpose, and you get these funky, sherried qualities in it. And it's unique.
Well, I mean, let's transition now a little bit. How long did it take to open Barbaloud? From when you first got the space, I believe it was a bank before or something like that.
Well, it was a shop before. There was a bank right next door to us, and
you got that space too,
right?
So, what's it take a year to build it from nothing in it to
they
ovens?
They were working on the space for a little bit of time because there were some challenges with the building, and there's like stuff like that. Whenever you get into a building that's a complete renovation, there's always going to be something. But the team and the whole everyone at Dynex was very good about it, and you know, we were working on the restaurant, and I still remember when the floor was cut out and the dining room was pretty much just like concrete and then a big curved looking metal ceiling with nothing on it and a hole in the floor, and they were pulling the kitchen through with like a pulley system and just through this hole in the ground. But the kitchen, it was funny, the kitchen was the first thing installed, and then the flooring all around the kitchen and everything. So, but then seeing the walls kind of made out of these little some of the walls that we had were made out of these like a couple feet tall like cardboard and plastic partitions to kind of show where a wall was going to be. And to now where we have all of this, the restaurant was done and you see it, and I took pictures all the way while we were building it and see, okay, cool, we have another wall here now, and then we have this here. And then
how long did that all take, a year or 2 years?
It took a couple of months actually.
Oh,
yeah, once the space was there and the kitchen was installed, it took us, you know,
2 months before friends and family?
About 2 to 3 months.
Wow, that's very fast.
Yeah.
And then once it opens with friends and family, how long before you, quote unquote, figure it out? And you're like, you know, I've worked 48 straight days and nights. Now I'm going to take a couple days off because we've, quote unquote, figured it out or figured enough out that I don't have to be, you know, watching every station. How long is a good goal for a big restaurant like that?
Well, you're still always going to be watching the station. You never want to take a look at it kind of like you're not needing to take care of something, because you kind of have to have that little bit of, like when you're a line cook, we call it like oven paranoia. You're always looking in your oven, make sure you didn't forget something. You're always checking up with your cooks and the things to make sure you're keeping a standard of quality with all the time. But there's a certain period of time. That's why when you make up your menu, you go through the test runs, you check up with everybody, that everybody knows what they're doing. You can get the product consistently. So when you're opening the doors up, you can get it going. But then, you know, there's another thing. Once you get the kitchen set, you have the service staff, and you want to train them the right way, make sure they can communicate with the guests properly. And there's things that I think, you know, even after the first few weeks, you're still figuring things out about your space, because especially with a new space.
It, where to put everything, all those things. You
know, well, you have space to store things, or even as simple as where do you put your dirty pots and pans on the line so that the dishwashers can still retrieve them and get them back to the line.
So how long before you change a menu? I mean, significantly past a dish or two, you know, here and there, just to stay new to people so that they keep coming back? Or do you not, if it's a winning concept?
Well, there's some dishes that stay on the menu just because they're classic and they're seasonal, like our Boudin Blanc, Boudin Noir, Coq au Vin, the beef tartare and steak frites, I mean, and the frisée salad. I mean, there's really no seasonal alley between those dishes, and it's more of the proteins that drive them. But there are things like right now, a beautiful heirloom tomato salad on the menu, or beets from the green market, or kind of like a corn chowder. But I would not make a corn chowder in the middle of winter. You know, so we'll change that up to something else to use that makes you feel in the season, or to kind of get you in the mood for that. So we'll change things, the menu, majorly 4 times a year.
Okay.
But then we'll do interseasonal kind of things too.
Now tell me about the longest time of all history. You know, then the using old classic dishes, but also wanting to, you're a young guy and you have young chefs and you want to bring new ideas to the game. So how does time itself, you know, is it baggage or is it discipline about classics? How does that work?
I think it's always fun to kind of look at, you know, like in my apartment, I have a humongous book collection and a lot of old school cookbooks, and it's some of the things that I inherited from family as well. And like I have like the first English edition of LaRousse. And some people are like, why would you even look at that? And I'm like, well, check it out and see what other people are doing now. And there's things in there like, we do the coq au vin, but it's not like what it looked in there, but it's based on the original dish. Or like there's something that you'd make up in the mountains, I call it a matelot, and you use like freshwater fish, but we're using, you know, some eels or some pike or something. But the way we use it and how we cook it and the ingredients we use to it are completely different, but it has a base in a historical part of French cuisine. So there's, you'd not always need to kind of have some kind of focus on your past so you can also keep going forward, I think.
Interesting. Yeah, of course. That's a great answer. And now, when's the decor going to change? All those stained tablecloths.
Oh, the little walls with the wine stains on them.
Is there a challenge to change decor every 10 years just so people feel like they're going to a new place?
I think every restaurant touches on that themselves, and they feel like, okay, after a set period of time, maybe we need to breathe a new kind of breath right in the dining room. And it could be something very little. It could be something very big and different. I mean, you have some of these restaurants that have been around for like a long time, you know, or diners that are around for a long time, and they kind of look at them like they're timeless classics, so don't touch them. But then you have restaurants that, you know, every 10, 15 years or so might do something a little different. But you're always going to have to upkeep on a restaurant. I mean, banquettes and chairs don't last forever. You're going to have to buy new ones eventually anyway.
Yeah. For sure. All those people coming in and out of those leather banquettes, those big people after their meals are like scratching it all up. Well, I mean, you are coming to your final days at Bar Balloon. I mean, it has been an amazing run from day one. That was like the first of all of those new restaurants of Danielle's that opened, and you were there, the only Italian, you know, running a restaurant for Danielle
French Balloon. Restaurant.
French restaurant. So it's been an amazing run. What's next?
Well, I'm planning on going up to up north. I'm going to be going up to Maine, and we have some plans, some ideas, and I've just been given a great chance and a great opportunity, and Danielle believed in me to run Bar Balloon and to execute his vision as what he wanted in a restaurant, and he also let me and gave me the ability as a mentor, too, for me to find myself as a chef. And I want to kind of bring that the next step and, become my own, you know, chef owner and, kind of eventually, be a mentor to other young cooks and chefs as well.
Well, what are you going to, I mean, how would you, can you distill even such a question? Like what are you going to take from him? Obviously opportunities, the opportunity to work with ingredients, things like that. But I mean, what is he, besides the opportunities he's given you by running a massive, New York restaurant, an institution already, what have you learned from him?
I mean, it can boil down to as simple as how silverware will rest in a bowl so that the guests don't have to kind of, if you put a spoon in a bowl, how far down the bowl will it go? Will it fall down too much and the guest has to pick it up the wrong way? Or thinking about like when we were opening up Bar Balloon, thinking about how heavy serviceware was so that the runners weren't too fatigued with carrying something that was too heavy all the time, or thinking about simplicity as well. Like, do you need everything? And he taught me about thinking more about guests and about service and not just about the food, because he's a chef and he loves what he does in the food, but also a restaurateur, and he's
a businessman.
He's a businessman too, but he also thinks so much about the guests, and I think that's why he's so successful as well, because he appeals to a lot of people. You know, and talking with him, and he's always, when he eats a dish, how he can eat the dish and how the dish can be eaten. So how will the guest enjoy the dish? You know, is it too sloppy? Is it too messy? Or sometimes maybe do we want to have it be a little messier, you know, because of what kind of food we're doing, you know? So there's all those little, like, it's always asking the questions and trying to figure it out.
Now, are those foods universal? I mean, they're obviously successful here in New York. Can you go to Maine and give the exact same foods, maybe a distilled version of it or something? Or do you think there's going to be a challenge to alter your menu? I mean, alter a menu like that for a crowd out there?
Well, I think what I'm going to be doing up there is not going to be like what I do here in essence. I mean, people that have eaten my food will see a style in it, but I'm not going to replicate dishes
sure.
that I've done. But I think that if you mix solid food in with good service and a welcoming atmosphere into a restaurant, I mean, if you look at any big restaurants that are successful and have lasted throughout the years, you have that kind of trifecta of the service, the hospitality, and the food all going for them. And, mm-hmm. you know, I've learned a lot of that with Danielle, and I hope to translate that into my own as well.
And will you come back once you get the place started and call, you know, come in or call in or whatever and tell us how it's going?
I mean, I've known you for how many years now? I mean, the turkeys and the pigs and all the stuff.
And the staff meal and all that. I mean, I mean, we had our business lives were definitely entwined, and, you know, Heritage's success. I mean, we never really took off in, you know, one of the, when we did take off, you guys were right there, becoming all of a sudden huge buyers from us for a charcuterie program for your restaurant. You always took 80, 90 pounds of staff meal, you know, a week, which was amazing. A business like ours that sells nose to tail needs that. So you took goats for Goat-tober, turkeys
for
Turkvember.
Those goats are so good. Anybody that hasn't done that, they need to sign up for it, because those goats, I mean, they're so tasty. They're so good. Oh.
The Dairy Farm goats. Well, listen, best of luck to you. I consider you a friend. I'm so happy you came on one of your last weeks. I wish Danielle the best of luck finding a sub for you, and keep us in the loop.
For sure.
We're sponsored by Cane Vineyards, engineered by Joe Galarraga. I'm Patrick Martins. It's the main course, and we will be back the week after Labor Day. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.